The person secretly liberated by his father's demise was Gordievsky himself. Anton Lavrentievich never told his family what he had done as a secret policeman during the famines and purges of the 1930s. Only years after his death did Gordievsky learn that his father had been married before he met Olga, and may have had children by this earlier, hidden marriage. Oleg, in turn, never explained to his father the nature of his work for the KGB, let alone his new loyalty to the West. The old Stalinist would have been appalled and terrified. The lies that had riddled the relationship between father and son continued to the grave. Gordievsky had secretly detested all that his father stood for, the blind obedience to a cruel ideology, and the cowardice of the Homo Sovieticus. But he had also loved the old man, and even respected his obstinacy, a trait they shared. Between father and son, love and deception ran in tandem. Gordievsky's remarriage was as swift and efficient as his divorce. Leila returned to Moscow in January 1979, and the wedding took place a few weeks later in a register office, followed by a family dinner at her parents' apartment. Olga was pleased to see her son so happy. She had never much cared for Yelena, regarding her daughter-in-law as a beady-eyed KGB careerist. The couple set up home in a new flat at 103 Leninsky Prospect, on the 8th floor of an apartment block owned by a KGB cooperative. "Our relationship was warm and close," wrote Gordievsky, "everything I had always longed for." The deception at the heart of this marriage was masked by the simple domestic pleasures of buying furniture, putting up bookshelves, and hanging the paintings brought from Denmark. Oleg missed the music and freedoms of the West, but Leila returned to the Soviet way of life without complaint or question. "Real happiness is to queue all night, and then get what you want," she said. Soon she was pregnant. Gordievsky was put to work writing a history of the Third Department, a non-job that offered an insight into past Soviet espionage, but none into current operations. Only once did he glimpse a file on the desk of a colleague in the Norwegian section with a heading that ended OLT, the first half of Traholt's name being covered up by another paper. Here was further indication that Arne Treholt was an active KGB agent. The British would be interested in this, he reflected, but not enough to run the risk of attempting to inform them. He made no attempt to contact MI6. An exile in his own country, he nursed his secret allegiance with lonely pride. In the whole of Russia, there was probably only one man who would have understood what Gordievsky was feeling. Kim Philby might be aging, lonely, and frequently plastered, but he was as intellectually sharp as ever. No one understood better, from long first-hand experience, the double life of the spy, how to avoid detection and how to catch a mole. He remained a figure of legend inside the KGB. Gordievsky had brought back a Danish book about the Philby case and asked the Englishman to sign it for him. The book came back with the inscription, "To my good friend Oleg, don't believe anything you see in print. Kim Philby." They were not friends, though they had much in common. For 30 years, Philby had secretly served the KGB from inside MI6. He now lived in comfortable semi-retirement, but his expertise in treachery remained at the disposal of his Soviet masters. Soon after Gordievsky's return, Philby received a request from the center, asking him to evaluate the Gunvor Huyk case and assess what had gone wrong. Why had the veteran Norwegian spy been arrested? For weeks, Philby pored over the Huyk files, and then, as he had done so many times in his long career, arrived at the correct conclusion. The leak which betrayed the agent could only have come from inside the KGB. Viktor Grushko summoned senior officers to his office, including Gordievsky. "There are signs that the KGB is leaking," Grushko declared, before presenting Philby's meticulous conclusions in the Huyk case. "This is particularly worrying, because the pattern of events suggests that the traitor may be in the room at this moment. He could be sitting here among us." Gordievsky felt a jolt of fear, and pinched his leg hard through his trouser pocket. Huyk had met more than a dozen KGB handlers during her long espionage career. Gordievsky had never been involved in running the case, and had no responsibility for Norway. Yet he was sure that his tip-off to Guscott had led directly to Huyck's arrest. And now, thanks to an elderly British spy with a nose for deception, the cloud of suspicion was wafting perilously close. He felt the nausea rise in his throat. Returning to his desk in a state of concealed shock, he wondered what else he had told MI6 that might come back to threaten him. Stig Berling once described the life of a secret agent as grey, black, white, and dull with fog and brown coal smoke. His own career as a Swedish policeman, intelligence officer, and Soviet mole was luridly colourful. Berling had worked as a policeman before enrolling in the surveillance unit of the Swedish Security Service, known as SÄPO, tasked with monitoring the activities of suspected Soviet agents in Sweden. In 1971, he was appointed SÄPO liaison with the Swedish Defence Staff, with access to highly classified information, including details of all Sweden's military defence facilities. 2 years later, while working as a UN observer in Lebanon, he made contact with Alexander Nikiforov, the Soviet military attaché and GRU officer in Beirut. On November 30, 1973, he sold a first cache of documents to the Soviets for $3,500. Berling spied for two reasons: money, which he greatly liked, and the overbearing attitude of his superior officers, which he didn't. Over the next 4 years, he supplied the Soviets with 14,700 documents, revealing Sweden's defense plans, weapon systems, security codes, and counter-espionage operations, and communicated with his Soviet handlers using secret ink, microdots, and shortwave radio. He even signed a receipt that read, "Money for information to the Russian intelligence service," which meant, of course, that he was now vulnerable to blackmail by the KGB. Berling was quite stupid. Then came Gordievsky's tip-off, pointing to a Soviet agent in Swedish intelligence. The MI6 director of counterintelligence flew to Stockholm and informed the Swedish security service that it had a spy in its midst. By this time, Berling had become head of SÄPO's investigation office, a reservist officer in the Swedish army, and secretly, a colonel in Soviet military intelligence. The Swedish investigators closed in. On March 12, 1979, at Sweden's behest, he was arrested at the Tel Aviv airport by Shin Bet, the Israeli security service, and handed over to his former colleagues in SÄPO. 9 months later, he was convicted of espionage and sentenced to life imprisonment. Berling had earned a small fortune from his Soviet spy masters. The damage he inflicted on Sweden's national defense cost an estimated £29 million to repair. One by one, the Soviet spies fingered by Gordievsky were being picked off. As a result, the West was probably safer. But Gordievsky was not. With internal suspicion building inside the Third Department, his career in the doldrums, but now happily married and expecting his first child, Gordievsky might, once again, have chosen to make a break with the past, sever all contact with MI6, hope the KGB never discovered the truth, and lie low for the rest of his life. Instead, he picked up the pace. His career needed a kickstart. He must get himself posted to the West, perhaps even to Britain itself. He would learn to speak English. The KGB offered a 10% salary increase to officers who passed an official foreign language course, with a maximum of two languages. Gordievsky already spoke German, Danish, and Swedish. He enrolled anyway. At 41, he was the oldest student in the KGB English course, which was designed to take 4 years. He completed it in two. If his KGB colleagues had been paying closer attention, they might have wondered why Gordievsky was in such a hurry to learn a new language without any financial incentive, and why he was suddenly so interested in the UK. Gordievsky bought a two-volume Russian-English dictionary and immersed himself in British culture, or as much of it as Soviet citizens were allowed to see. He read Churchill's History of the Second World War, Frederick Forsyth's The Day of the Jackal, and Fielding's Tom Jones. Mikhail Lyubimov, who had returned from Copenhagen to take up a prestigious position as head of the first chief directorate think tank, recalled how his friend frequently dropped in for a chat and asked for sage advice about England. Yubimov was delighted to oblige, happily expatiating on the joys of London clubland and Scotch whisky. What an irony, Yubimov later wrote. There I was, giving advice on England to an English spy. Layla also helped him with his studies, testing him at night on his English vocabulary and picking up some of the language herself. I was so envious of his ability. He could learn 30 words in one day. He was brilliant. At Lyubimov's suggestion, Gordievsky began reading the novels of Somerset Maugham. A British intelligence officer during the First World War, Maugham brilliantly captures the moral fogginess of espionage in his fiction. Gordievsky was particularly taken with the character of Ashenden, a British agent sent to Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution. Ashenden admired goodness, but was not outraged by wickedness, wrote Maugham. People sometimes thought him heartless, because he was more often interested in others than attached to them. To further improve his English, Gordievsky helped to translate Kim Philby's reports. Like other government officials of his generation, Philby wrote and spoke a convoluted form of upper-class bureaucratic English. Whitehall Mandarin, a languid drawl with extended vowels, was exceptionally difficult to render in Russian, but it offered a useful primer in the arcane language of British officialdom. The British and Scandinavian sections operated side by side within the Third Department. Gordievsky began cultivating anyone who might assist him to transfer to the British side. In April 1980, Layla gave birth to a daughter, Maria, and the proud father invited Viktor Grushko, his department head, and Lyubimov to come and celebrate with him. Grushko and I were invited to a dinner of Azerbaijani delicacies, prepared by his mother-in-law, Lyubimov recalled. She told us about the merits of her husband, who had worked in the Cheka. Gordievsky showed off the paintings he had collected in Denmark. The problem with buttering up the boss is that bosses tend to move on, which can mean a lot of wasted butter. Mikhail Lyubimov was suddenly and ignominiously fired from the KGB. Like Gordievsky, he fell foul of the center's moralists, but his sin was worse. With his second marriage failing, he had fallen in love with the wife of another officer, and then failed to inform the KGB before his next appointment. He was dismissed without appeal. Lyubimov had been a useful source of secrets, but also a patron, advisor, ally, and close friend. The irrepressible Lyubimov declared his intention to become a novelist, the Russian Somerset Maugham. Viktor Grushko was promoted to deputy head of the FCD, and succeeded as head of the Third Department by Gennady Titov, the crocodile, the former resident in Oslo, and Arne Treholt's case officer. The new head of the Scandinavian-British section was Nikolai Gribin, a glamorous figure who had served under Gordievsky in Copenhagen in 1976, but had since leapfrogged ahead of him in the KGB hierarchy. Gribin was slim, neat, and handsome. His party trick was to pick up a guitar and strum mournful Russian ballads until everyone in the room was weeping. He was exceptionally ambitious and made an art of cultivating senior officers. The bosses thought him a splendid fellow. Gordievsky, by contrast, regarded Gribin as a creep, a typical toady and careerist. But he needed his support. Gordievsky held his nose and poured on the sycophancy. In the summer of 1981, Gordievsky passed his final exam. His English was far from fluent, but he was now at least theoretically qualified for a posting to Britain. In September, a second daughter, Anna, was born. Layla was proving to be a first-class mother and an attentive and dutiful wife. She was marvelous in the home, Oleg reflected. Gordievsky was no longer a figure of scandal. An early sign of rehabilitation came when he was asked to write the department's annual report. He began to attend more important meetings. Even so, he was beginning to wonder if he would ever gain access to secrets important enough to justify resuming contact with MI6. Back in Century House, the Sunbeam team was pondering exactly the same question. 3 years had passed without a whisper from Gordievsky. The signal site on Kutuzovsky Prospect was carefully monitored, and Operation Pimlico, the escape plan, was kept in permanent readiness. A full dress rehearsal was staged. The head of station and his wife drove to Helsinki along the exfiltration route. Guscott and Price met them on the other side of the Finnish border, and then drove all the way north to the border with Norway. In Moscow, every Tuesday evening at 7:30, whatever the weather, a member of the MI6 station, or one of their wives, would monitor the pavement outside the bread shop, a Mars bar or Kit Kat at the ready, and watch for a man in a grey cap holding a Safeway bag. Every third Saturday in each month, an MI6 officer carrying a Harrods bag would stand near the clock in the central market, pretending to shop, alert for the brush contact signal. Her Majesty's government still owes me £10 for one winter tomato, probably the only one in Moscow, one officer recalled. Gordievsky never appeared. That year, Jeffrey Guscott was appointed MI6 head of station in Sweden, in part because if the Swedish-speaking Gordievsky was sent abroad again, there was a chance he might pop up in Stockholm. He never did. The case had gone into deep hibernation, from which it showed no signs of waking. Then came a heartbeat, clear evidence of life, courtesy of the ever-reliable Danish intelligence service. Pet was also intrigued to know what had become of the Russian spy. A Danish diplomat, who regularly visited Moscow, was asked to inquire, casually, during his next trip, about Comrade Gordievsky, the charming Russian consular official who spoke such good Danish. Sure enough, at the next reception attended by the visiting Dane, there was Gordievsky, looking confident and healthy. The Danish diplomat reported back to Pet that Gordievsky had remarried and was now the father of two daughters. The confirmed sighting was swiftly relayed to MI6. The most significant element in the Pet report, however, and one that sent a surge of excitement through the Sunbeam team, was contained in a single remark dropped by Gordievsky over the cocktails and canapés. With studied insouciance, Gordievsky had turned to the Danish diplomat and observed, "I am now learning to speak English." Chapter 6. Agent Boot. Gennady Titov had a problem. The head of the Third Department of the First Chief Directorate had a vacancy for a KGB officer in the Soviet Embassy in London, but nobody to fill it. At least no one who could be relied on to kowtow to Gennady Titov, a prime qualification for the job. The crocodile was one of those people, familiar in every large bureaucracy, who dispenses patronage on the understanding that the recipient will thereafter be a slave. Titov was boorish, scheming, unctuous toward his superiors, and sneering to his underlings. One of the most unpleasant and unpopular officers in the whole of the KGB, in Gordievsky's estimation, but he was also one of the most powerful. Expelled from Norway after the arrest of Gunvor Huyk, he had a reputation as a crack spymaster, and continued to run Arne Treholt at long distance, meeting him regularly for enormous lunches in Vienna, Helsinki, and elsewhere. On his return to Moscow in 1977, Titov had won swift promotion by playing brutal office politics, flattering his bosses, and appointing his cronies to key positions. Gordievsky loathed him. The centre had been struggling to rebuild its London station ever since 1971, when more than 100 KGB officers were expelled in Operation Foot. There were simply not enough able English-speaking officers to make up the shortfall. The KGB had comprehensively penetrated the British establishment during the 1930s, inflicting enormous damage through Filby and the so-called Cambridge spy ring, but its inability to repeat this feat was a source of deep frustration. Various illegals had been infiltrated into the country, and a number of KGB officers were working as journalists or trade representatives, but there was a dearth of spies who could operate effectively under formal diplomatic cover. In the autumn of 1981, the KGB's deputy head of the PR line in Britain, ostensibly a counselor at the Soviet Embassy in London, returned to Moscow. The first candidate to replace him was rejected by the Foreign Office because he was suspected by MI5, rightly, of clandestine activities. To fill this plum posting, the KGB needed someone with experience abroad, who spoke English, had a record as a legitimate diplomat, and would not be vetoed out of hand by the British. Gordievsky began dropping hints that he, and only he, met the criteria. Nikolai Grybin, the newly appointed head of the British Scandinavian section, was encouraging, but Titov wanted his own creature in London, and hitherto Gordievsky had not demonstrated the requisite degree of subservience. A period of intense jockeying ensued, with Titov attempting to maneuver his own candidate into the post, while Gordievsky exhibited what he hoped was the right combination of enthusiasm, obsequiousness, and fake humility. He lobbied without being obvious, quietly disparaged any rivals, and soft-soaped the crocodile until the suds flew. Finally, Titov relented, though he doubted the British would grant a visa. Gordievsky's well known in the West, he remarked. They may easily reject him, but let's try anyway. Gordievsky was extravagant in his gratitude. Inwardly, he relished the revenge he might soon inflict on the crocodile. As the wife of a KGB officer on the way up, Layla was also overjoyed at the prospect of moving to Britain, in her mind, a land of almost mythical fascination. The two little girls were growing fast. Maria was a sturdy toddler, energetic and independent. Anna was just uttering her first words in Russian. Layla imagined herself taking her well-dressed, English-speaking daughters to school in London, shopping for food in vast and overflowing supermarkets, and exploring the ancient city. Soviet propaganda portrayed Britain as a place of downtrodden workers and rapacious capitalists, but her time in Denmark had already introduced Layla to the realities of life in the West, and she had briefly visited London in 1978 as part of the Russian delegation to a World Health Organization conference. Like many couples embarking on a shared adventure, the prospect of building a new family life in a foreign country brought them even closer. Together, they excitedly imagined a place of wide streets, endless classical music concerts, delicious restaurants, and elegant parks. They would be able to wander the city, read whatever they wanted, and make new British friends. Gordievsky described to Layla the Englishmen he had met in Copenhagen, witty, sophisticated people, full of laughter and generosity. Denmark had been exciting, but they would be even happier in London, he said. When they first met, 4 years earlier, Gordievsky had painted a picture of how they would travel the world, a successful KGB officer with his beautiful young wife and their growing family. Now he was making good on that promise, and she loved him all the more. But Gordievsky also imagined scenes he did not share with Layla. The KGB Residentura in London was one of the most active in the world, and he would be handling secrets of the first importance. He would re-establish contact with MI6 as soon as it was safe to do so. He would spy for Britain, in Britain, and one day, perhaps soon, perhaps years hence, he would tell MI6 he was finished. Then he could defect. He would finally reveal his double life to his wife, and they would remain in Britain forever. This he did not tell Layla. For both husband and wife, the London posting was the fulfillment of a dream. But they were different dreams. Gordievsky was issued a new diplomatic passport. The visa application form was filled out and sent to the British Embassy in Moscow. From there it was dispatched to London. 2 days later, James Spooner, the head of MI6's Soviet section, was sitting at his desk in Century House when a junior entered and breathlessly declared, "I've got some big news." She handed over a sheet of paper. "Look at this visa application that has just come through from Moscow." The accompanying letter stated that Comrade Oleg Antonievich Gordievsky had been appointed counselor at the Soviet embassy and requested the British government to issue a diplomatic visa forthwith. Spooner was ecstatic, but you would never have been able to tell. The son of a doctor and Scottish senior social worker, at school, Spooner had belonged to a club for particularly gifted boys. He emerged from Oxford University with a first-class degree in history and a passion for medieval architecture. He was outstandingly clever and exceptionally precise in his judgments, but it was hard to tell what he was really thinking, said one contemporary. Spooner joined MI6 in 1971, another club for the particularly gifted. Some predicted he had the makings of a future chief of the service. MI6 has a reputation for swashbuckling, for taking risks and following hunches. Spooner was the reverse. He tackled the complexities of intelligence work like an academic historian, He would later commission the first authorized history of MI6, assembling the evidence, sifting the facts, arriving at a conclusion only after consideration and reconsideration. Spooner was not a man who rushed to judgment. Rather, he approached judgment very slowly, incrementally, and fastidiously. In 1981, he was just 32, but had already served as an MI6 officer operating under diplomatic cover in Nairobi and Moscow. He spoke good Russian and was fascinated by Russian culture. During his time in Moscow, the KGB had attempted to involve him in a classic dangle, an approach by a Soviet naval officer offering to spy for Britain. As a result, Spooner's posting was cut short. In early 1980, he had taken over P5, the operational team, including Veronica Price, running Soviet agents inside and outside the Soviet bloc. In many ways, he was the polar opposite of Gennady Titov, his counterpart in the KGB. Allergic to office politics, immune to flattery, and rigorously professional. The Sunbeam file was one of the first to land on his desk. With Gordievsky in Moscow, incommunicado and professionally becalmed, the case had floated in limbo. "It was obviously right not to make contact," said Spooner. "The strategic decision-making was very good. We were playing for the long term. Of course, we had no idea what was going to happen. We had no reason to think he was going to get to London. But now, Gordievsky was coming in from the cold, and after 3 years of inaction and suspense, James Spooner, Jeffrey Gascott, Veronica Price, and the Sunbeam team swung into action. Spooner called in Price and showed her the visa application. "I was really quite pleased," said Price, which was her equivalent of being wildly overexcited. "This was terrific. It was just what we had hoped for." "I must go away and think," she told Spooner. "Don't think too long," said Spooner. "This needs to get to sea." Issuing a visa for Gordievsky was not a straightforward task. On principle, any suspected KGB officer was automatically barred from entering Britain. Under normal circumstances, the Foreign Office would make a preliminary inquiry and discover that Oleg had twice been posted to Copenhagen. A routine information request to the Danes would reveal that he was listed in their files as a suspected intelligence officer, and the visa would be summarily rejected. But these circumstances were not normal. MI6 needed Gordievsky to be admitted to Britain without delay, and with no questions asked. The immigration authorities could simply be instructed to issue the visa, but that might arouse suspicions, since it would signal that there was something different about Gordievsky. The secret could not be allowed to seep outside MI6. Once alerted, Pett was pleased to help. Told by MI6 that the Foreign Office would soon come asking questions, the Danes massaged the record and responded that while there had been suspicions, there was no proof Gordievsky was KGB. "We managed to leave enough doubt so that the visa went through normally. We said, yes, he's been flagged by the Danes, but it's not completely certain." As far as the Foreign Office and immigration authorities were aware, Gordievsky was just another Soviet diplomat. Possibly spooky, but perhaps not, and certainly not worth making a fuss about. The British Passport Office usually took at least a month to issue diplomatic visas. Gordievsky's permit to enter Britain as an accredited diplomat arrived in just 22 days. In Moscow, that seemed suspiciously swift. "It's very strange they granted you the visa so quickly," an official in the Russian Foreign Ministry observed darkly when Gordievsky went to pick up his passport. "They must know who you are. You've been abroad so much. When your application went in, I felt sure they'd turn it down. They've rejected so many requests lately. You can count yourself very fortunate." The sharp-eyed official probably kept his suspicions to himself. The KGB bureaucracy was much slower. 3 months later, Gordievsky was still awaiting formal permission to leave the USSR. The Fifth Department of Directorate K, the KGB's internal investigation wing, was looking into Gordievsky's background and taking its time. He began to wonder if there was a problem. In Century House, too, anxiety levels were rising. Jeffrey Gascott, in Sweden, was told to stand ready to fly to London at a moment's notice, to receive Gordievsky on arrival. But he did not arrive. Had something gone wrong? As the weeks of waiting stretched out, Gordievsky spent his time profitably perusing the files in KGB headquarters, one of the most secretive and impenetrable places on Earth, unless you were on the inside. The internal security system in Moscow Center was both complex and crude. The most secret operational files were kept in a locked cabinet in the office of the department head. But the other paperwork was retained in the various section offices, and in individual safes handled by the officers overseeing different aspects of the department's work. Every evening, each officer locked his safes and filing cabinets, placed the keys in a small wooden box, and then sealed this with a lump of plasticine, into which he pressed his individual stamp, like the wax seals used on ancient documents. The duty officer then collected the boxes and placed them in another safe in Gennady Titov's office. That key was again placed in a small box and sealed in the same way with the duty officer's stamp before being deposited in the office of the secretariat of the First Chief Directorate, which was manned around the clock. The system took up a great deal of time and a lot of plasticine. Gordievsky occupied a desk in room 635, the political section of the British department. In three large metal cupboards were files on individuals in the UK, regarded by the KGB as agents, potential agents, or confidential contacts. Room 635 housed only active cases. Redundant material was moved to the main archive. The files were stored in cardboard boxes, three to a shelf, each box containing two files, sealed with string and plasticine. To unseal a file required a signature from the department head. In the British cupboard were six files on individuals classified as agents, and another dozen listed as confidential contacts. Gordievsky began exploring, building up a picture of the KGB's current political operations in Britain. The deputy department head, Dmitry Svetanko, teased him for cramming. "Don't waste too much time reading, because when you get to Britain, you will realize what it is like." Gordievsky continued his research, hoping his reputation for diligence would be enough to offset any suspicions. Every day, he would sign out a file, break the seal, and discover another Briton the KGB was either fishing for or had its hooks into. These individuals were not spies, properly speaking. The PR line primarily sought political influence and secret information. Its targets were opinion formers, politicians, journalists, and others in positions of power. Some of these were considered conscious agents, knowingly supplying information, secret or otherwise, in a clandestine way. Others were classed as confidential contacts, helpful informants with varying degrees of knowing complicity. Some accepted hospitality, holidays, or money. Others, merely sympathizers to the Soviet cause, were not even aware the KGB was cultivating them. Most would have been astonished to know that they merited a codename and a file in a locked steel cupboard inside KGB headquarters. Nonetheless, these were people of a different caliber to the nobodies the KGB station had pursued in Denmark. Britain was a major target. Some of the cases stretched back decades, and some of the names were shocking. Jack Jones was one of the most respected figures in the trade union movement, a crusading socialist once described by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown as one of the world's greatest trade union leaders. He was also a KGB agent. A former Liverpool dock worker, Jones had fought for the Republicans in the international brigades during the Spanish Civil War, and by 1969 he had risen to become General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union, TGWU, once the largest union in the Western world, with more than 2 million members, a position he held for almost a decade. An opinion poll in 1977 found that 54% of voters considered Jones to be the most powerful person in Britain, with greater influence than the Prime Minister. Genial, outspoken, and intransigent, Jack Jones was the public face of the unions. His private world was more dubious. Jones had joined the Communist Party in 1932 and remained a member until at least 1949. He was first approached by Soviet intelligence while recuperating from wounds sustained during the Spanish Civil War. A bugging operation at Communist Party headquarters in London revealed that Jones, according to one MI5 report, was prepared to pass to the party government and other information which has been passed to him confidentially in his trade union capacity. The KGB formally listed him as an agent, codenamed Dream, the Russian transliteration of Dream, between 1964 and 1968, when he handed over confidential Labour Party documents which he obtained as a member of the NEC, National Executive Committee, and the party's International Committee, as well as information on his colleagues and contacts. He accepted contributions toward his holiday expenses, and was regarded by the KGB as a very disciplined, useful agent, passing on intelligence about what was happening in No. 10 Downing Street, about the leadership of the Labour Party, and about the trades union movement. The Prague Spring in 1968 led Jones to break off his relationship with the KGB, but the files indicated that there had been sporadic contact in the years since. He had retired from the TGWU in 1978, pointedly turning down a peerage, but he remained a forceful figure on the left. Gordievsky noted clear indications in the file that the KGB wished to revive its association with him. A second dossier was devoted to Bob Edwards, the left-wing Labour MP, another former dock worker, Spanish Civil War veteran, trade union leader, and long-term KGB agent. In 1926, Edwards had led a youth delegation to the USSR and met both Stalin and Trotsky. Over a long political career, Edwards had proved a willing informant with access to high-grade secrets. There is no doubt, MI5 later concluded, that the MP would have passed on all he could get hold of to the KGB. He was secretly awarded the Order of the People's Friendship, the third highest Soviet decoration, in recognition of his undercover work. His case officer at that time, Leonid Zaitsev, Gordievsky's former boss in Copenhagen, met Edwards in Brussels to show him the medal in person, before taking it back to Moscow for safekeeping. In addition to the big fish, the files contained a number of smaller fry, such as Lord Fenner Brockway, the veteran peace activist, former MP, and General Secretary of the Labour Party. Over many years of dealings with the KGB, this confidential contact had accepted a great deal of hospitality from Soviet intelligence, without ever, it seemed, producing anything of much value in return. By 1982, he was 94 years old. Another file related to a journalist at the Guardian newspaper, Richard Gott. Back in 1964, while working for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Gott had been approached by a Soviet embassy official in London, the first of several contacts with the KGB. He relished his brush with the spy world. "I rather enjoyed the cloak-and-dagger atmosphere, which will be familiar to anyone who has read the spy stories of the Cold War," he later said. The contacts resumed in the 1970s. The KGB gave him the codename Ron. He accepted Soviet paid trips to Vienna, Nicosia, and Athens. Gott later wrote, "Like many other journalists, diplomats, and politicians, I lunched with Russians during the Cold War. I took red gold, even if it was only in the form of expenses for myself and my partner. That, in the circumstances, was culpable stupidity, though at the time it seemed more like an enjoyable joke." Like all spy agencies, the KGB was prone to wishful thinking and invention when reality got in the way. Several of those identified in the files were simply left-wingers, perceived as potentially pro-Soviet. The campaign for nuclear disarmament was regarded as a particularly fertile recruiting ground. "Many were idealists," Gordievsky noted, "and most gave their help unwittingly." Every target was given a codename, but that did not make them spies. As is often the case in intelligence work, the political files contained a great deal of material that was simply culled from newspapers and journals, and then dressed up by the KGB in London to appear secret, and therefore important. But there was one dossier that stood out from all the others. The cardboard box contained two folders, one 300 pages thick, the other perhaps half that size, bound with old string and sealed with plasticine. The file was labeled Boot. On the cover, the word agent had been crossed out and confidential contact inserted. In December 1981, Gordievsky broke the seal and opened the file for the first time. On the first page appeared a formal introductory note. I, Senior Operational Officer, Major Petrov Ivan Alexeyevich, herewith open a file on the agent Michael Foot, citizen of the UK, giving him the pseudonym Boot. Agent Boot was the Right Honourable Michael Foot, distinguished writer and orator, veteran left-wing MP, leader of the Labour Party, and the politician who, if Labour won the next election, would become Prime Minister of Britain. The leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition had been a paid KGB agent. Gordievsky recalled how, back in Denmark, Mikhail Yubimov had described his efforts to woo an up-and-coming Labour MP in the 1960s. In his memoirs, with a heavy-elbowed nudge to anyone in the know, Yubimov referred to the London pub where he did his recruiting as the Yubimov and Boot. Gordievsky knew that Michael Foot had risen to become one of the most prominent politicians in Britain. For the next 15 minutes, he flipped through the file, his pulse rising. Michael Foot occupies a peculiar position in political history. In later years, he became a figure of ridicule, mocked as Wurzel Gummidge for his dishevelled appearance, donkey jacket, thick spectacles, and knobby walking stick. But for 2 decades, he was a towering figure on the left of the Labour Party, a highly cultured writer, an eloquent public speaker, and a politician of vigorous conviction. He became that most peculiar of British animals, a national treasure. Born in 1913, he began his career as a journalist, edited the socialist newspaper Tribune, and was elected to Parliament in 1945. His first cabinet appointment came in 1974, as Secretary of State for Employment under Harold Wilson. The Labour leader James Callaghan was defeated by Margaret Thatcher in 1979 and resigned 18 months later. Foot was elected leader of the Labour Party on November 10, 1980. "I am as strong in my socialist convictions as I have ever been," he said. Britain was deep in recession. Thatcher was unpopular. Opinion polls put Labour more than 10 percentage points ahead of the Conservatives. The next general election was due in May 1984, and there seemed a good chance that Michael Foot could win it and become Prime Minister. The Boot file, if it became public, would put paid to that in an instant. Major Petrov clearly had a sense of humour and had been unable to resist the pun on Foot, Boot, when choosing a code name. But the rest of the dossier was deadly serious. It described, step by step, how a 20-year relationship with Foot had evolved since the late 1940s, when the KGB decided that he was progressive. At their first meeting with Foot, in the offices of Tribune, KGB officers posing as diplomats slipped £10 into his pocket, worth roughly £250 today. He did not object. One sheet in the file listed the payments made to Foot over the years. This was a standard form with the date, amount, and name of the paying officer. Gordievsky scanned the figures and estimated there had been between 10 and 14 payments during the 1960s of between £100 and £150 each, so roughly £1,500 in total, worth more than £37,000, $49,000 today. What happened to the money is unclear. Yubimov later told Gordievsky that he suspected Foot might have kept some for himself, but the Labour MP was not a mercenary man, and it seems more likely the cash was used to prop up Tribune, which was perennially broke. Another page listed the case officers who had run Agent Boot out of the London Residentura, by both real name and codename. Gordievsky immediately noted Lubimov, codenamed Korin. "I quickly looked through the list. One of my objectives was to see if there was somebody else I knew, and find out who were the officers able to manipulate such a man. There was also an index, 5 pages long, an inventory of every person mentioned by Foot in conversation with the KGB. The meetings took place roughly once a month, frequently over lunch at the Gay Hussar restaurant in Soho. Every rendezvous was carefully planned. 3 days beforehand, Moscow sent an outline of what should be discussed. The resulting report was read by the PR line chief in London, then the resident, before being sent on to Moscow Center. At each stage, there was an evaluation of the developing case. Gordievsky read a couple of reports in detail, and skimmed another half a dozen. I was interested in the language and style of those reports, and what they reflected of the relationship. They were better than I expected. The reports were not very imaginative, but they were intelligent, well written. This was a very developed relationship, sympathetic on both sides, with confidentiality on both sides. They spoke with cordiality, and lots of specifics, saturated with real information. Yubimov had been particularly skilled at running foot, and paying him. Mikhail Petrovich would put money in an envelope and put it in his pocket. He had such elegant manners that he could do it in a convincing way. What did the KGB get in return? Gordievsky recalled, Foote freely disclosed information about the labor movement to them. He told them which politicians and trade union leaders were pro-Soviet, even suggesting which union bosses should be given the present of Soviet-funded holidays on the Black Sea. A leading supporter of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, Foote also passed on what he knew about debates over nuclear weapons. In return, the KGB gave him drafts of articles encouraging British disarmament, which he could then edit and publish, unattributed to their real source, in Tribune. There was no protest by Foote to the KGB over the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956, and he quite often visited the Soviet Union to a top-level welcome. Foote was exceptionally well-informed. He provided details on internal machinations within Labour, as well as the party's attitude toward other hot topics. The Vietnam War, the military and political consequences of Kennedy's assassination, the development of Diego Garcia as a U.S. base, and the Geneva Conference of 1954 to settle outstanding issues from the Korean War. Foote was in a unique position to provide the Soviets with political insight, and receptive to the Soviet line. The manipulation was subtle. Michael Foote would be told, Mr. Foote, our analytical people came to the conclusion it would be useful if the public knew such and such. Then the officer would say, I have prepared some material. Take it and use it if you like it. They discussed what would be nice to publish in the future, in his own paper and others. Never was it acknowledged that Foote was being served raw Soviet propaganda. Boot was a peculiar sort of agent who did not exactly fit the KGB definition. He did not conceal his meetings with Soviet officials, though he did not advertise them either, and since he was a public figure, these were impossible to arrange clandestinely. He was an opinion creator, and therefore more an agent of influence, a term of art, than an agent, a specific term of espionage. Foote would not have known that the KGB classified him as an agent, an internal definition. He retained his intellectual independence. He leaked no state secrets, and at that time had no access to any. He doubtless believed he was serving progressive politics and the cause of peace in accepting Soviet largesse in support of Tribune. He may even have been unaware that his interlocutors were KGB officers, feeding him information and passing whatever he revealed back to Moscow. If so, he was stunningly naive. In 1968, the Boot case changed gear. Foote was intensely critical of Moscow in the wake of the Prague Spring. At a protest rally in Hyde Park, he declared, "The actions of the Russians confirm that one of the worst threats to socialism comes from within the Kremlin itself." No more money changed hands. Boot was downgraded from agent to confidential contact. The meetings became less frequent, and by the time Foote was running for the Labour leadership, they had ceased entirely. But from the KGB perspective in 1981, the case remained open and might yet be revived. The Boot file left Gordievsky in no doubt. The KGB regarded Michael Foote as an actual agent until 1968. He took cash directly from us, which meant we could regard him in good conscience as an agent. If an agent takes money, it is very good. A reinforcing element in the relationship. Foote had not broken the law. He was not a Soviet spy. He had not betrayed his country. But he had taken direction and secretly accepted money from, while providing information to, an enemy power, a totalitarian dictatorship. If his relationship with the KGB was discovered by his political rivals, Inside as well as outside his own party, it would destroy his career in a moment, decapitate the Labour Party, and ignite a scandal that would rewrite British politics. At the very least, Foote would be sure to lose the next election. Lenin is often credited with coining the term useful idiot, polezny durak in Russian, meaning one who can be used to spread propaganda without being aware of it or subscribing to the goals intended by the manipulator. Michael Foote had been useful to the KGB and completely idiotic. Gordievsky read the boot files in December 1981. The following month, he read them again, committing as much as he could to memory. Dmitry Svetanko, the deputy department head, was surprised to find Gordievsky still buried in the British case histories, particularly when he had told him not to bother. "What are you doing?" he asked abruptly. "I am reading the files," said Gordievsky, trying to sound matter-of-fact. "Do you really need to? I thought I should be thoroughly prepared." Svetanko was unimpressed. "Why don't you write some useful paper rather than wasting time reading those files?" he snapped, and left the office. On April 2, 1982, Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands, Britain's outpost in the South Atlantic. Even Michael Foote, leader of the opposition and apostle of peace, called for action, not words, in response to Argentine aggression. Margaret Thatcher dispatched a task force to repel the invaders. In Moscow Center, the Falklands War provoked a violent upsurge of anti-British feeling. Thatcher was already a hated figure in the Soviet Union. The Falklands conflict was yet another example of British imperialist arrogance. The hostility of the KGB was almost hysterical, Gordievsky recalled. His colleagues were convinced Britain would be defeated by plucky little Argentina. Britain was at war. Gordievsky, alone within the KGB, was on Britain's side. He wondered if he would ever reach the country to which he had sworn secret allegiance. Finally, the KGB's Fifth Department gave Gordievsky the all-clear to travel to Britain. On June 28, 1982, he boarded the Aeroflot flight to London, with Layla and their daughters, now aged 2 and 9 months. He was relieved to be on his way, anxious to re-establish contact with MI6, but the future remained murky. If his work for Britain succeeded, he would eventually have to defect, and might never return to Russia. He might never again see his mother or younger sister. If he was exposed, he might well come back, but under KGB guard, to face interrogation and execution. As the plane took off, Gordievsky's mind was heavy with the accumulated mental baggage from 4 months of tense secret study in the KGB archives. Making notes of what he had uncovered would have been far too dangerous. Instead, in his head, he carried the names of every PR line agent in Britain and every KGB spy in the Soviet embassy in London. He brought evidence of the identity of the fifth man, the activities in exile of Kim Philby, and further proof that the Norwegian, Arne Treholt, was a spy for Moscow. And most important of all, he brought memorized details of the boot files, the KGB dossier on Michael Foote, a surprise gift for British intelligence, and an exceptionally volatile lump of political explosive. Part 2. Chapter 7. The Safe House. On the outside, Aldrich Ames was just an averagely unhappy CIA officer. He drank too much. His marriage was collapsing in a slow and unspectacular slither. He never had enough money. His job trying to recruit Soviet spies in Mexico City on the fringes of the Cold War was surprisingly dull, and just unproductive enough to ensure a steady stream of chivying demands from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Ames felt underappreciated, underpaid, and undersexed. He had recently received a number of reprimands for getting plastered at a Christmas party, forgetting to lock a safe, and leaving a briefcase containing photos of a Soviet agent on a train. But there was nothing in his work record to indicate he was anything other than uniformly mediocre, reliably second-rate, and inconspicuously idle. Tall and spare, with thick spectacles and a mustache that never seemed fully confident of itself, he was hard to spot in a group and invisible in a crowd. There was nothing special about Ames, and that, perhaps, was the problem. Deep inside Rick Ames was a canker of cynicism, hard and inflamed, growing so slowly that no one had noticed it, least of all Ames himself. Ames had once harbored big dreams. Born in River Falls, Wisconsin, in 1941, he had a 1950s childhood that looked like the sort of idyllic suburban dream depicted on cereal boxes, concealing its share of depression, alcoholism, and quiet despair. His father had started life as an academic and ended up working for the CIA in Burma, passing money to Burmese publications secretly bankrolled by the U.S. government. As a boy, Ames read Leslie Charteris's thrillers featuring Simon Templar, the saint, and imagined himself as a dashing, debonair British adventurer. He wore a trench coat to look like a spy and practiced magic tricks. He liked fooling people. Ames was intelligent and imaginative, but reality never seemed to measure up to his hopes or furnish him with what he considered his just deserts. He flunked out of the University of Chicago and worked for a while as a part-time actor. He resented authority. If asked to do something he didn't want to do, he didn't argue. He just didn't do it, according to a contemporary. He finally scraped together a degree and drifted into the CIA on his father's suggestion. "Lying is wrong, son, but if it serves a greater good, it's okay," said his father, through an increasingly thick fog of bourbon. The CIA's junior officer training course was intended to inspire patriotic devotion to duty in the complex and demanding world of intelligence gathering. But it could have other effects. Ames learned that morality can be malleable. The laws of the United States overrode those of other countries. And a greedy spy was worth more than an ideological one, because once you had the money hooks in, it was easier to hold them and play them. Agent recruitment, Ames came to believe, depended on the ability to assess a person's vulnerability. Once you knew a man's weakness, you could snare and manipulate him. Disloyalty was not a sin, but an operational tool. "The essence of espionage is betrayal of trust," Ames declared. He was wrong. The essence of successful agent running is the maintenance of trust, the supplanting of one allegiance by another, higher loyalty. Ames was posted to Turkey, a center for the espionage war between East and West, and began putting his training into practice by recruiting Soviet agents in Ankara. Ames decided he was a natural spymaster, with the ability to focus on a target, establish a relationship, and manipulate myself and him into the situation I aimed for. His bosses, however, considered his performance no more than satisfactory. After the Prague Spring, he was instructed to paste up hundreds of posters at night with the slogan, "Remember 68," to give the impression that the Turkish population was outraged by the Soviet invasion. He dumped the posters in a bin and went for a drink. Returning to Washington in 1972, Ames took a training course in Russian and spent the next 4 years working in the Soviet East European Department. The ship he joined was not a happy one. The revelation that Richard Nixon had used the CIA to try to obstruct a federal investigation into the Watergate burglary in 1972 triggered a crisis within the agency and a series of investigations into its activities over the preceding 20 years. The resulting reports, known as the Family Jewels, identified a damning litany of illegal actions far outside the CIA's charter, including wiretapping of journalists, burglaries, assassination plots, experimentation on humans, collusion with the mafia, and systematic domestic surveillance of civilians. James Angleton, the CIA's cadaverous orchid-collecting counterintelligence chief, had almost destroyed the CIA with his internal mole hunts, based on the obsessive and erroneous belief that Kim Philby was orchestrating the mass penetration of Western intelligence. Angleton was finally forced to retire in 1974, leaving behind a legacy of profound paranoia. The CIA was also falling behind in the spy war. Thanks to the excessive zeal of Angleton and his counterintelligence staff, "we had very few Soviet agents inside the USSR worthy of the name," said Robert M. Gates, who was recruited at around the same time as Ames, and went on to head the CIA. The agency would undergo wholesale reform over the next decade, but Ames had joined when it was at its lowest ebb, demoralized, disorganized, and widely distrusted. In 1976, he was moved to New York to try to recruit Soviet agents, and then posted on to Mexico City.